Well, back to tonight, it's just after 6:30 and we come to Opera on Three, which was recorded during Opera North's autumn season in Leeds. It was introduced by Tom Redmond.
A very good evening and welcome to West Yorkshire, where you join me in Leeds Grand Theatre, an opera house, for a revival of Opera North's Little Greats project, a concept that first took place in 2004 when Opera North presented 8 one-act operas. The company's autumn 2017 season sees a return to the format that allows audiences to take, mix and match whichever of the 6 operas on offer that they choose. But with me here tonight in the Grand Theatre in Leeds is writer, musicologist, teacher and conductor Nigel Simeone. Nigel, welcome. It's an extraordinary way to mix these operas up, isn't it? We've got 6 on offer. Leoncavallo's Pagliacci, Ravel's L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, Masciani's Cavaliera Rusticana, Trial by Jury, bit of Gilbert and Sullivan, Janacek's Ossud and Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti. I mean, it's an extraordinary mix of operas, isn't it?
It is, and it'd be quite a nice party game to see just what the most absurd combinations would be. Actually, it's a wonderful collection of short, in most cases, one-act operas, and several of them not heard very often, exactly because they're one-act operas.
Well, tonight we're going to hear 2 of those said rarities. Later on, Bernstein's one-act Trouble in Tahiti. And before it, Janacek's short 3-act Ossud, or Destiny. Now, where does Ossud fit into Janacek's canon?
Well, I guess the most famous Janacek opera is still Yennefer, which was first performed in 1904. And Ossud was the opera he finished a year later. So it's a piece that's very close to Yennefer in terms of chronology, but quite a long way on in terms of the musical language, which sounds much more like what we're maybe used to in some of Janacek's later operas, like Cunning Little Vixen and Catcher.
I mean, it is actually, this score is really very much in that familiar Janacek sound world.
It really is, isn't it?
Why does it come under that sort of umbrella of rarity?
First of all, it's quite difficult to program, so, you know, it's an odd length. But secondly, it's got a very convoluted plot that has tended to put people off from performing it. It has worked really well in places in the past, English National Opera in the 80s, for instance. But there's no doubt about it, the story is a bit of a dog's dinner. The music, on the other hand, is simply marvellous.
It's difficult to explain the plot of this opera, but actually, when you watch it, it's terribly clear. It's enormously romantic and very affecting. And it's really a study of one person's life and their breakdown and their relationship to their art. It's like reading 3 consecutive Chekhov short stories. The first time your 2 protagonists meet is not quite sure whether it's by chance or design. And the woman, Mila, says to the man, "Have you come for our baby?" That's her first line. So you think, okay, they had an affair, which resulted in a baby. And it was stopped by Mila's mother, who in the opera is in fact the direct or indirect cause of Mila's death. By Act 2, Mila's mother is deranged because Mila and Givny get back together again and they do live together with their little boy. And Mila's mother, I think, is so maddened by this situation. She throws herself off a balcony and Mila is dragged to her death with her mother, very Janacek.
Tonight's director, Annabel Arden. Well, we're going to hear it sung in English this evening in a translation by Rodney Bloomer, revised by tonight's conductor, Martin Andre, in a translation that you say works better than the original Czech libretto, doesn't it?
Well, Janacek had the idea for the story, but he sent it to a young friend of his, actually a friend of his daughter's, and said, "Can you turn this into an opera libretto?" Because she was a wannabe poet. So she turned it into this very flowery kind of art nouveau libretto. What the English one does is to kind of clarify and simplify all of that, really probably more convincingly than the Czech does.
Well, what of the music of Ossud? John Graham Hall sings the role of the composer Givny.
I feel it's all incredibly lyrical, wonderfully passionate, and I sort of do feel, and I still feel, after having been rehearsing this piece for some time, and it's the second time I've done it, that it's really among the best music he ever wrote. I've done Katia Kabanova many times. I think Katia is absolutely sensational, wonderful music, but I think Ossud is right up there with it. Why is it good? Because Janacek, in a way that no other composer, I think, apart from Britain does, is he is somehow able to reflect the emotional state of the character exactly in the way the music is written. Therefore, it's possible to treat the performance as an acting performance in which the music simply magnifies in that wonderful operatic way all the emotions that Givni is going through.
John Graham Hall. Although the opera is comparatively short, it does divide into three clear acts, and they'll be given tonight with just a short break between each. Before the drama begins to unfold, we are to know that Mila Valkova, sung tonight by Giselle Allen, has had an affair with the composer Givni, tenor John Graham Hall. Givni was neither rich nor respectable enough to please Mila's mother, who contrived to drive a wedge between Givni and Mila, and even introduced Mila to someone more appropriate as her future husband. What Mila's mother didn't know was that Mila was pregnant with Givni's child, and the marriage plan came to nothing. However, Givni was convinced that he had been jilted for a richer man, and he put all his bitterness into an opera that he was writing. Well, in a staged prologue, Givni is at a conservatory with a group of students. The stage is set in a classroom scene. Givni thinks back on his past, and we find ourselves in the first of several time shifts in the opera. Scene one takes us back 20 years. We're in a spa town on a fine day. Crowds are enjoying the sunshine, and Givni has come to find Mila. They haven't seen each other since their affair came to an end. Their greeting is awkward, but the crowd speculate that the two know each other. Mila asks if Givni has come for his son, but their conversation is interrupted by a schoolmistress, Miss Stula, mezzo Anne Taylor, trying to rehearse a choir of women schoolteachers in a party song. Dr. Suda, a rival composer, sung by Peter Orty, sings a satirical ballad which leads to a lively dance, after which the chorus set off for a picnic. Meanwhile, Mila and Givni have found somewhere secluded, and gradually they fall in love all over again. When the picnickers return, Mila and Givni have disappeared, much to the horror of Mila's mother.
Yes, Mila's mother is a bit of a Janáček type. In Yennefer, it had been a sort of mother-in-law type character who had buried the baby in the frozen pond. In Katya Kabanova, famously, it was a mother-in-law who more or less brought about Katya's demise. So this one's rather true to form.
And so now, Act One of Janáček's Osud, performed here at the Grand Theatre in Leeds by Opera North. The orchestra of Opera North is led by David Greed and conducted by Martin Andre. And we begin in Givni's music class at the Conservatoire, in the present.
You may begin. Thank you. accept these flowers, dear lady. Please accept these flowers, dear lady, as a token of admiration.
Looks an arty type, a composer perhaps.
He's easily composed and built a post-mortem on youthful passion. On love unrequited. Tis for someone's I've no idea and don't wish to know. Yes, from the town where I was born, his music breathes the landscape well. He's always been inspired by nature.
If we stand in your way.
I've no wish to intrude on you. May I present myself?
Well, my dear lady, pray allow me.
There's no need.
meet, we are acquainted.
See me, composer, top the Suda. Gotsky, painter. Composer, perhaps, why perhaps, what do you mean by that?
Would you say a good composer? Just tell the story of love's worst anguish.
Love's worst anguish.
Of love's worst anguish. The anger, the bitterness, the pain of a youthful passion. Youthful passion. His youthful passion.
You ought to know. I fancy that these two know each other rather well. Why pry on them? Even to
I take my leave. If you allow me,
if you allow me.
Thank you.
must eat, 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 to keep us drinking.
Make that for two, I think.
Oh,
it's for you to choose.
Choose.
as if the two of us had any choice.
Do go on. How gladly, how gladly I return to those days. How gladly. Silent and passionate glances transformed our empty existence. And filled it with a blazing light that no one and nothing could extinguish. We did not heed the outside world, whose darkness only made our light brighter.
In ruins. Turns them into a scarlet flower, ripe for plucking, while in your arms I've spent the day admiring you, reveling in the sun.
Why ever will enjoy the party? I wonder.
Crying eyes find no satisfaction.
First act of Janáček's Ozud, performed by Opera North, coming to a close with Rosalind Plowright as Mila's mad mother. Mila was sung by Giselle Allen, Givni by John Graham Hall, Dr. Zuda by Peter Orty, and Miss Stula by Anne Taylor. Well, Nigel Simeone, that was a gripping first act, wasn't it?
It certainly was, wasn't it? Not a happy lady, the mother-in-law.
No, she's certainly not. And we're about to see her get even more unhappy,
well,
aren't
quite,
we?
Yes, yes.
So there's some amazing scenes in there, weren't they? I particularly the folk dancing of the chorus was spectacular, wasn't it?
Wonderful. And also the bit where the schoolgirls are rehearsing with Miss Stula. And what's amazing about that is that when you look at the score, you see that each of those little moments is chopped up into a separate scene. It's almost like reading a TV script. I think there's something like 17 scenes in that first act. They fly by at an incredible rate of knots. It's this wonderful, very novel approach, actually.
And musically as well, we're very much amongst nature, aren't we?
I think so, yes. But we're also in a town, and that's the difference. You know, in Yennefer you have the kind of clacking of the mill wheel and all that at the start. Here we're straight into an elegant town square with fashionable holidaymakers from Brno, Prague, wherever. Yes, we're in nature, but we're in a particularly kind of what you might call cosmopolitan nature, you know?
But the effects on the stage were very, very effective, weren't they? You know, we started off in that classroom and then the chairs are whisked away by the chorus members in a dreamlike whirlwind.
I thought that worked terribly well. As you were saying earlier on, you know, originally they did a whole flashback thing where bits of the music were shifted around. What this evening's production showed is that you can achieve that effect of it all being a flashback without ruining a thing, I mean, without moving a thing. I thought that was terribly clever, and actually it does give you a kind of reason for what they're all doing at a spa town 15, 20 years beforehand.
So as we enter Act 2, we jump forward 5 years to find Givni and Mila married and living with their son Dobek and Mila's mad mother. The appearance of Givni and Mila has changed. Dressed in whites and finery in Act 1, we find them in tatty housecoats, clearly down on their luck as the penniless Givni struggles with his and Mila's past. The otherworldly voice is the sound of Mila's mother, Rosalind Plowright, taunting her daughter.
Thank you. slumbering echo of a time that is past. Sleeping music, wake, sleeping music. And secure our freedom. How sweetly you come to charm us, promise our hearts the love and certainty that we both long for. That we both long for. Yet you bear witness the lingering doubts that weigh on our souls. Must I leave you to reproach me in silence, deprived of your public? The victim of your creator's conscience, dare I awaken you? Must I let you rest in peace forever? Yet this is the music I wrote when first we fell in love. That remains incomplete. A strange situation.
You have completed an opera with no end.
We must let this music sound at least once to exercise its power to haunt us and to silence it. Even an echo.
No regret having written this music.
Regret it.
You play it so often, this testament of my shame.
May we not hear it just once, without recrimination? Do you still remember what I wrote in my first letter?
I do, little Dobrik, Ultonana.
I saw the beauty of your eyes, dimmed by bitter weeping. Heavenly bird of paradise, broken by love of suffering.
May I believe this?
I
is afraid to linger, yet belongs to both of us. I have surrendered my will to your will. The forest echoes with our cries. I am pining anxiously. You are sighing and waiting. My soul is pining in fearful torment. And if you summon me, I will come again. I will come again. This is how I took revenge. I wanted to tear out the heart from your body and expose your wounds in public, sounding your death knell, howling with laughter. I wanted to bathe in the tears you shed and strike at your breast with a knife, hacking at you till I killed you. Pretenses and tear out the mask that concealed your debauchery to anyone and everyone. You gave your heart and soul as well. You gave the world your body. Thank you.
Silence, silence. silence, silence. And a bolt from a clear sky. With nothing to warn us of lightning, to warn us of it, I was then a thunder.
Two of Janáček's Ossuť performed here in Leeds by Opera North. Mila's Mother was sung by Rosalind Plowright, Mila by Giselle Allen, Givney by John Graham Hall, and The Young Dobek by Bryn Mashburn. Nigel Simeone, that very dramatic death of Mila and her mother, we didn't quite see them fall from the balcony, but viewed it through the window with a sudden flash of light. Very cleverly done.
I also love the kind of almost disturbingly claustrophobic atmosphere of this dysfunctional little family gathered around the piano, listening to Papa playing his music from however many years ago, with Mother loathing it because it reminded her of her transgressions, or whatever the phrase used. Meanwhile, you know, the mad mother-in-law literally kind of wailing off stage about how terrible it all is, and especially her son-in-law is. It's quite a striking scene, isn't it?
And Rosalind Plowright was brilliantly bristling with madness, wasn't she?
Fabulous. Absolutely bitter and twisted.
And the music is becoming far stormier now, isn't it?
Yeah, and about to become stormier still. I mean, we are about to enter Thunderland, so much so that after the orchestra storm finishes, the students carry it on by themselves in order to maintain the atmosphere, to keep it all as grim and as threatening as possible.
Well, you're listening to Opera on Three. We're just approaching the third act of Janáček's Ossuť here in Leeds. Act Three finds us 15 years later again, or back in the present. The students we saw in the prologue are now trying out a storm scene from an unfinished opera written by their professor Givney, which is about to receive its premiere under the watchful eye of Dr. Suda. The students think the opera, called The Three Roses, is in fact an autobiographical portrait of Givney himself. When Givney enters, the students ask him to tell them something of the opera. He's lost in his thoughts of Mila, and it all becomes too much. Well, against the sound of a storm breaking outside, Givney relates his story, and having done so, falls prostrate on the floor. The opera ends with Givney singing, "The final act will remain unfinished. It's in God's hands."
Oh. Come on, feel the load of the secrets. happened to change that. People said it must have been his falling in love.
Falling in love.
Please, would you switch the light on? It's getting dark outside.
That must really be wonderful. As if she
didn't happy he was then. He felt that God was smiling on him. Confidence blossomed within him. No longer lonely, his passion embraced all humanity. And from the breath of love, what inspiration came to him? What spontaneous melody flowed from a soul that seemed born again? Had to draw its inspiration from his store of passionate fantasies. Soon his libretto spread to life, and it conveyed so well his laughter and joy, his pain, his tale. His own pain.
And how much pain it gives
him. Where once their spirits shared a life of perfect unison, do
know their existence was always threatened. By strident rivers. Heavy thunder, crashing and beating down the hill. And in the storm, strings that had bound them snapped in two. She became a ghostly shadow, aimlessly wandering, cowering and timorous, a broken reed, blown helplessly hither and thither. And Lenski. Dead wood seven from living branches, torn and heedlessly cast aside, scattered by the storm winds, haunted by a sense of failure. In revenge he made this opera an attack on her, and a hope that her guilt would shame her into loving him once more. The winds that blew the broken reed blow her back to him again, to this fragment of dead wood still battered by the storm. Who knows? Maybe they were right to say it was chance when Lenski and Mila met at the spa. Golek, fetch me a glass of water. Who would have recognized Lenski when they met again? Full of love and deeply happy. Full of love and deeply happy. Both of them drowned. How could he have realized that love so tender and harmonious would soon be silenced by the nearness of death? How could he forget? How could he forget? Listening to her last breath, listening to her last sigh. An interrupted melody, torn from her, torn from her dying lips.
Understand to understand, please start to understand.
From then on, no.
no sound came to him. Except for the menacing rumble of thunder. Ever louder and louder still, it hurtled around in his head. He tried to challenge that music to silence it forever through his will. Where ancient and lime trees shook, he watched in terror the preaching of man of God. There in the lightning's flash he saw the gates of infinity. Surprise, he stood and gazed at the blinding gleam of silver light. He knew the dark clouds meant the storm was near.
Oh, stop his broken
eyes!
Oh, stop his
like
broken
bird in a
stop
him! Oh, can't you see it too? Where the silver lightning shatters into fragments, there is a pale face, so white and so sad. Now I see you again. See you so clearly again.
Givney, overcome with memories and emotion, the final act of his opera, The Three Roses, in God's hands, and there it will stay. Janacek's Ossut, performed here in Leeds Grand Theatre by Opera North. Nigel Simeone, what a dramatic ending.
What an absolutely magnificent performance of Givney. Completely engrossing on the stage. A kind of pathetic, broken man, but so powerful. That was marvellous.
The chorus of Opera North currently bowing, and the cast making their way onto the stage. Full cast list and photos of this production available on the Opera on Three pages of the Radio 3 website. Both our Dobeks coming onto stage now. Young Dobek, played by Bryn Mashburn, and Warren Gillespie playing Dobek as a much older man. Rosalind Plowright on the stage, who left us in Act 2 as Mila's mother. And Giselle Allen, the role of Mila Volkova, acknowledging the orchestra of Opera North, conducted by Martin Andre. And here is John Graham Hall. As Nigel Simeone was saying, a broken character, but absolutely extraordinary performance of Givney here in Leeds. Giselle Allen bringing Martin Andre onto the front of the stage, who brings the orchestra of Opera North to its feet. Nigel Simeone, any further thoughts on that production that we've just seen?
Well, we know that it's a problematic opera in terms of the story, but I don't think I've ever seen a production that clarifies so much of that. The sort of narrative thread of, you know, man, woman, child comes along, mad mother-in-law, was incredibly clear. I also like the look of the production. You know, it was quite clever to move it all on a few years from, obviously, when it was originally written. But the other thing I loved about the way that last act was staged was the kind of warmth that the students had for Givney. It was a very strong sense of them kind of supporting and profoundly sympathising with his plight, which made it even more touching somehow.
But you're listening to Opera on Three with me, Tom Redmond, coming from Leeds Grand Theatre with an evening of little greats from Opera North. Six short operas that could be mixed and matched however the audience desire. But joining me is Nigel Simeone, musicologist, writer, conductor, composer, and knower of all things Janacek. Well, I mentioned that the Little Greats initiative creates some interesting pairings. Tonight, Janacek's Ossut is paired with Leonard Bernstein's jazz-infused 1952 opera Trouble in Tahiti, seemingly on a different planet to the Janacek. Nigel, is it possible to find any common ground between these two operas?
I suppose where it lies is with the idea of a dysfunctional family. I say that because Bernstein names the male lead in this opera Sam, which was the name of his father, and in a letter to his sister in early 1951 when he was working the opera, he said to her that he was going to name actually the two principal characters Sam and Jenny, which were his parents' names. Now, the female lead ended up being called something else. He was deeply affected by his father's hostility to his musical career. His father worked for a hair product company. Now, they had a good, comfortable middle-class upbringing, but there was obviously some resentment lying there. This isn't a bitter and twisted opera, but I certainly think the inspiration behind it had a lot to do with Bernstein's family circumstances, yes.
In Trouble in Tahiti, Bernstein explores sort of the language of 1950s American consumerism. He wrote his own libretto as well, didn't he?
Absolutely. And actually, in terms of the sound the music makes, you know, Janacek laces Ossut full of wonderful arrangements of things that sound as if they might be folk tunes. At the same time, the soundtrack of Trouble in Tahiti, if you like, is this wonderful group of kind of, well, I was going to say Andrew's sisters, but, you know, two of them are men. But the idea of a sort of trio of backing singers is somehow a fantastically American 40s thing. The themes, as in the dramatic themes, are vernacular, but so too's a lot of the noise the music makes in both these operas, actually. I don't think you could mistake Trouble in Tahiti for something that wasn't American music.
No, we're based, you know, in 1940s, 1950s America, you know, the time of American consumers when Americans could have it all. That's really the world we're about to explore, isn't it?
And particularly striking, I suppose, for anyone in Europe, because, of course, that's exactly what Europe was not able to enjoy. So I think the Americans probably woke up to the horrors of consumerism as well as its pleasures a long time before we did, because they actually had the stuff.
Well, Trouble in Tahiti is about a relationship floundering through boredom, suspicion and mistrust brought about by the emptiness of that consumerist world. Here are some thoughts prompted by the background research for tonight's production by director Matthew Eberhardt.
In America, there was a sort of a suburban area called Levittown, a company called Levitt and Sons, and they, during the war, manufactured sort of, you know, wartime goods and developed the whole sort of production line, you know, aspect to creating products. And when the war finished, they said, right, they got commissioned to design and build these houses. And the rate at which these were going up was sort of phenomenal. Houses every day. And it absolutely was sort of like a production line. So, you know, all these identical houses. And, yeah, we shared with the performers, you know, photos of these things. And they're sort of terrifying, really, to believe that, you know, your house is this one house in this sort of enormous area of thousands of other houses. And they are all identical. And I think there were certain rules, like you couldn't plant your own trees. You know, the trees that were planted, that is what had been designed. You couldn't sort of play around with that. And the white picket fence was the look. You couldn't go, I want my own fence, you know. So it's absolutely fascinating. And I think that world, understanding that world and how that feels, was really central to our sort of understanding of who these characters are. Because it is about a couple who are sort of in an unhappy relationship. In a different time and a different place, maybe this couple would be okay. But in this particular context, in this, you know, new, you know, early 50s, you know, suburbia, they're just sort of in the worst position in a way. And it's the context that fuels the kind of the disharmony, as it were, in their relationship.
Tonight's director, Matthew Eberhardt. Nigel, looking at the programme book for tonight's performance, there's an incredible image of Levittown, this idea of a house being bought off the peg, the white goods in the centre and the building being put up around it. It's extraordinary to see, isn't it?
It's quite incredible. There are all the white goods in place before even the walls go up, which kind of makes the point, I suppose, about what, certainly in America, people's middle-class expectations were in the years after the war. Real consumerism as we know it.
Well, the family at the centre of Trouble in Tahiti are husband and wife, Sam and Dinah, and their young son, Junior, who's present but also remains silent throughout. Sam and Dinah are living the American dream, immaculately dressed, beautiful home, all of which in this production is simply implied.
They have everything. That's the idea, this family. They've got all the mod cons in the kitchen. And you either do a production where you have all of those things and you really give them the house that they are living in. Or what we did is, well, actually, it's the adverts. You know, it's one thing having something, but it's really about wanting things that's important and a culture of wanting more stuff. So the idea of having adverts sort of very present in the design was sort of immediately felt very clear to us.
Well, key to the narrative of Trouble in Tahiti is a trio of singers that Bernstein describes as a Greek chorus born out of a radio commercial, sung tonight by Fleur Wynne, Joseph Shovelton and Nicholas Butterfield. We're introduced to them beneath a large suspended chrome microphone in an RKO studio with an illuminated on-air sign. There's no coincidence that they sing in the style they do, the happiest type of music that existed, announced through wide smiles and sparkling teeth and saccharine-sweet descriptions of perfection in suburbia. Now, their first line actually takes its melody from Bernstein's earlier musical, On the Town, as the trio sings, Suburbia.
It's no accident either. I think Bernstein was a notorious self-borrower, a bit like Handel. If he had a good tune, he'd use it again. And I think here he just wants to kind of underline the kind of irony between the sort of middle of New York City where he was living and this strange artificial environment just outside New York called Levittown, which is a kind of incredible parallel universe to what was going on in the city.
Well, the trio sing of the sunrise waking a couple. It kindles their love and kisses the windows and kisses the front door. We're about to witness a day in the life of an idyllic husband and wife living in the burbs. Real life contrasts greatly with this sugar-coated description of perfection as we see our two main protagonists at breakfast with their son, alternating between bickering and lyrical moments of longing and kindness. Dinah, sung by soprano Wallace Junta, suspects her husband Sam, Kieran DeLange, of having an affair with his secretary. Well, as the couple bicker at breakfast, Dinah reminds Sam that their son, Junior, has a school play that afternoon. Sam insists he can't go because he has a handball tournament at the gym. Sam's very much the successful alpha male breadwinner of 1950s America. The arguing continues, but they agree that this is no way to live. They ask each other for help to love you again. Sam leaves the house, late for his train. In scene two, we see Sam in his office doing very important business. The jazz trio return to sing. When it comes to the dollar, no one touches Sam. Overlapping Sam's office scene, the stage set is in two halves, we hear from Dinah. Dressed in an immaculate, fashionable yellow A-line dress, she's recalling a dream in which she was standing in a garden.
This is when she's in her analyst's office. She presumably goes regularly and talks about a lot of things, but in this particular session, she's talking about a dream that she's had. The garden represents not an actual garden, not an actual place that she wants to go to, but a feeling of peace and contentment. She has come to this realization that even though she's got all the boxes ticked and she's got everything that you're supposed to have in life, she's extremely unhappy, unfulfilled, yearning for something that she can't quite explain what it is. But in this dream, she hits on a few things. A certain person who I think might have been a first love or a former flame. A person who symbolizes what she wants. She's painting him with these qualities, and it's, of course, it's a dream. But he represents all the things that she doesn't have. The quiet place that Bernstein so often talks about in this piece and also its sequel. And I think also in West Side Story, too, there's a place for us.
Soprano Wallis Junter, who sings the role of Dinah. Well, the scene changes again, this time to a New York sidewalk where Sam and Dinah run into each other. Rather than taking time to have lunch together, they seem flustered, talk of other commitments and head in opposite directions, singing to themselves as they yearn for their lost happiness. Next, we see Sam in the gym, a simple set with a chair and a mirror. On the wall is a poster stating, "Don't be half a man." Sam's won his handball tournament, and clutching his trophy, he sings of the importance of being a winner. Meanwhile, Dinah escapes her troubles and woes by spending an afternoon at the movies, watching the technicolored film Trouble in Tahiti.
I think this is a lovely example of 50s American escapism. The first thing she says in her very amusing aria about this is what an absolutely terrible film it is. And in one sense, that's true. On the other hand, the idea of escaping to this kind of Shangri-La, it sounds to me very much like music from the Caribbean. I'm not sure if Bernstein was entirely sure where Tahiti was on a map.
Well, at first, Dinah is dismissive of the film, but gets caught up in the escapist fantasy of it all. Eventually, feeling self-conscious, she notices the time and rushes home to cook dinner for Sam. We cut to the outside of the couple's house where Sam is singing of another law of men, that even winners must pay through their nose for what they get. After dinner, at a spectacularly authentic melamine table, Sam decides it's time to talk. He doesn't know where to begin. It's the only spoken dialogue in the opera. Sam suggests they go to the movies to see a new film about Tahiti. Dinah says okay, and they leave, wondering if it's possible to rediscover their love for one another. Until then, they opt for the bought and paid for magic of the silver screen. But Nigel, all of this is delivered with so many of Bernstein's trademark sounds and styles. Is it a hybrid of musical and opera?
I don't think so. I really do think this one's an opera with which borrows elements from the Broadway stage. It did, of course, have a short life for about a month on Broadway, but on a weird triple bill with a play by Tennessee Williams and so on. I think Bernstein always had this one as an opera. He told his wife that he was composing little operas and was loving it. It's a shame he never tried any more after this.
So time now for Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti. The orchestra of Opera North is conducted by Tobias Ringborg. And we open with our close harmony trio as they make their way before the giant RKO studio microphone suspended from a cradle to the left of the stage.
Scarsdale, friend. friendly sun opens the eyelids, opens the eyes, opens the eyelids, opens the eyes of the husband and wife, kindles their faces, kindles their love, kindles their faces with greetings of love in the little white house in Wellesley.
Suburbia,
suburbia, our little spot, out of the hubbub, less than an hour by train.
Suburbia,
suburbia, sweet in the spring, healthful in winter, saves us the bother of summers in May. Morning sun kisses the driveway, kisses the lawn, kisses the flagstones on the front lawn of the little white house. Kisses the paper at the front door, kisses the roses around the front door of the little white house in Ozone. The little white house, the little white house.
Daddy Boo. Sofa, so far, so automobile, automobile, sofa, so far, ever over de boo, Everton over, skiddly day, skiddly day, da, a Barbanel who, but a Barbanel buys a visa. Ready boo, sofa, so far, so automobile, automobile, sofa, so far, ever over de boo, Everton over, skiddly-day-da, a Barbanel who, but a Barbanel buys a vis-a-vis.
Suburbia,
suburbia, parts for the kids, neighborly butchers, less than an hour by train.
Good morning, sun, says a good morning.
Have a good day, have a good morning. Have a good day in the city today. Joy to your labors till you return. Joy to your labors until you return
to the little white house.
To the little white house.
To the little white house.
To the little white house in Highland. The little white house. 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 The little white house, the little white house. Skiddly day, skiddly day. Ready, boom.
How could you say the thing that you did?
Oh, you see it this time.
Front of the kid.
You were the first to go up and
smoke. Oh, is it my fault?
I just meant a joke.
Pass me the toast.
You might have said please.
Please understand, I don't mean to fight.
Why do you start then?
It's simply not right.
Righteous old Sam, so quick to accuse.
Here we are fighting.
The language you use.
This coffee is burned.
Make it yourself. Every morning it's the same old thing. Lovely way to start the day.
There are things that have to be discussed.
There certainly are.
Me and Miss Brown, that homely old bird.
Still young enough to.
It's simply absurd.
Still young enough.
The subject is closed.
Oh, I'm sick of this life, day after day. All of the same humiliation, day after day, with no consideration of what it means to be a woman.
Try, Sam,
oh, try to be kind.
good morning, have a good day, have a good morning, have a good day in the city.
Oh, you know, it's Junior's birthday.
Is it his birthday?
Oh, no, it's the play.
Oh, I forgot, that office school show.
Junior's the hero.
What time do we go?
At 4 on the dot.
Fine, I'll be there. Sorry, I can't. I'm doing the gym.
Sam, we promised.
Oh, what's it to him?
Everything, Sam. You really must try.
Donna, I'm sorry.
Who's wearing your tie?
I'm due at the gym.
To hell with the gym.
Don't you see? Today's a special day. A handball tournament and all.
No, I don't see why it's so important.
To me, if I win today, I win the gold cup.
Isn't that dandy?
The tournament cup.
You and your cup, your ego is wild.
That's important.
But think of your child.
Oh, Junior's all right.
Handball indeed.
You need your life, leave me to mine.
Oh, you're selfish.
We'll get on fine.
Give the child, and he should come
can't
first.
Can't you stop right?
I'm ready to burst.
Oh, this can't be the way. Why can't we watch, have a friendly conversation? Must we descend to this vulgar demonstration? Once and for all, let's stop this brawling. Tonight we'll talk it over. Relaxed and candid and free. Should be. Mr. Partridge. I'm perfectly fine, thank you. She's well. Yes, exactly what I want to speak to you about. With things as they are, I cannot see how you could ask me again. Now, Mr. Partridge. Yes, I know all that. You've already said that. Ah, but that's just why I have to refuse you. No. No. Yes, I was sure you would finally see it my way. No trouble at all. Goodbye.
Oh, Sam, you're a genius, you marvelous man.
Oh, Bill, good morning.
I couldn't be better, Bill. She's well. Yes, the check is already signed and waiting. Now don't be a child, you know it's a pleasure to do it for you. Is it sufficient? Don't be silly, man. Of course I can spare it. You return it whenever you want to. Sure. Bye. Hey, you forget to show up for the handball finals. At 4 on the dot. So long.
Oh, Sam, you're an angel. You'll be calling back. Oh, Sam.
Shouts, furious cries, and won't you sit down, please? Right there. No, it's only a question that I want answered. Now tell me the truth. Have I ever made any passes at you? Answer the question. I've forgotten that. Well, it wasn't much more than an accident, was it, Miss Brown? She forgot that the incident ever happened. The letters can wait. That's all.
Business lunch. Too bad we can't have lunch together.
I must run, I'm late already. See you tonight.
See you tonight.
silences began.
It's a wonderful life, up-to-date kitchen, washing machines, colorful bathroom and Life magazine, and a little white house in Brookline. Lovely life, Sheraton sofa, Chippendale chair, Applewhite table, bone chinaware. It's a wonderful life, real solid silver, wine in the soup, two-door sedan and convertible coupe, and a little white house in Elkins Park.
Suburbia,
6 days of work, fun every Sunday, golf with the neighbors next door.
Suburbia,
vitamin B,
chlorophyll to paste. Who could ask heaven for anything more? Lovely life, oodles of culture over TV, book of the month club, musical tea. It's a wonderful life, happily married, sweet little son. Family picture, second to none. In the little white,
in the little white,
in the little white house,
in the little white, in the little
white, white house in Bloomfield. The little white house, the little white house, the little white house, the little white house,
Delaware Pond.
The little white house, the little white house,
Beverly.
The little white house, the little white house.
Swimming and fish who wind up in the pot. There are men who will study the books till judgment day and examine the techniques of winners galore. There are men who will practice the roles religiously. Every day they'll improve just a tiny bit more. And they'll put all their soul behind it, all their ego, power, drive, and will, and desire behind it. And they'll throw themselves in. But they never will win, they never will win, they never, 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 never will win. Fattish and fish that are trimming the fin. There are men who will sweat out their days in cabinets and be pummeled and battered and beaten and robbed. There are men who will sweat out their nights in Turkish baths. They'll buy every reducing machine that is sold. And they'll live for a week on lemons, and another week on grass and water and crackers and lemons, and lay off of the gin. But they'll never be thin, they'll never be thin, they'll never, 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 never be thin. A nature boy, a hero in a story with a wonderful soul. Men are created unequal. There are men that whatever they touch will turn to gold, and their every decision will always be right. There are men that can handle the work of seven men, and so manage to sleep 7 hours a night. Against them, all your fire, snow, and hail, the darkest disaster against them. There is
respond with a grin. For they always will win, they always will win, they always, 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 always will win.
I love.
that the payments begin, and I have to go in, I have to go in, I have to go in.
What did you say?
It doesn't matter.
How is Junior's play?
I didn't go.
Look, Dinah. Maybe we ought to go out somewhere tonight, huh? A movie or a.
We went last night.
But there's a different one tonight. Just opened that new musical, something about a. Tahiti? How about it?
Sure. Why not? Anything. I'll get my hat.
Waiting in time.
Is there a
Sam, Dinah, and Junior making their way towards the bright lights of a silver screen. Leonard Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti, performed here in Leeds by Opera North. Our trio of jazz singers, our narrators, Fleur Wynne, Joseph Shovelton, Nicholas Butterfield, taking applause. Now Sam, sung by Kirine DeLange. Dinah, Wallace, Gunter. And the character of the son, Junior, played by Charlie Southby. A silent character, but an important member of the cast, nonetheless. Nigel, it's an incredibly simple production, isn't it? But so incredibly effective.
I couldn't agree more. And I think what's lovely is that the kind of slightly edgy tenderness of it comes over so well here. That was the thing that Bernstein always had at the heart of this piece, was not to play it for laughs, but the kind of rather uneasy unhostility that goes on. And I thought they captured that really beautifully in the singing and in the production as well.
The orchestra conducted by Tobias Ringborg. Tobias Ringborg on the stage now with the cast, bringing the Orchestra of Opera North to its feet. Actually, for me, what really stuck out was actually how timeless that story is, and worryingly how the fashions of the 50s have returned, the same thin tailoring on the suits, the light blue, the brown shoes, and the story is still so relevant, isn't it? Our obsession with consumerism and our escape to the big screen.
Of course it is. I think that's absolutely true. It manages to be very much of its time, but to also have this sort of eternal quality about it. There's a lovely kind of sort of American idyll feel about it almost, and I think that's something else that's timeless.
Well, it has been an extraordinary evening with Opera North and two of their little greats. But as the theatre empties around us, from my guest Nigel Simeone and everyone at Opera North, it's time to say goodbye from Leeds and good night.
That was Tom Redmond. Next week's opera comes from the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, where it hasn't been seen for more than 120 years. It's Rossini's Semiramide, with Joyce DiDonato in the title role, and it begins a little earlier next Saturday at 6 o'clock. Now, we've just heard Leonard Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti. Next year is Bernstein's centenary. There'll be all kinds of celebrations. So let's have another quick preview, as it were. This is music from a couple of decades later, his Chichester Psalms, a recording conducted by the composer himself.
Thank you.
Oh.
Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms, the Vienna Boys Choir and the Israel Philharmonic conducted by the composer. The treble soloist was Gunter Turing. Now, in a few minutes here on Radio 3, Between the Ears eavesdrops on a journey north to spend a Yuletide in the land of ice and fire. So till then, I thought I'd establish the Nordic atmosphere with Grieg. That was Homesickness from Grieg's sixth book of lyric pieces. The pianist was Leif Ove Andsnes.